Listening to the Bogus Otis Show. It's the only podcast dedicated to my buddy Sammy. Sammy Hagar, that is. What is understood need to be discussed, especially if it's about Sammy Hagar.
Hey, Land's End, you have to see it. Ain't no picture ever say it right. Walking the streets doing the old Cabo Wabo place come to life every night. Come to life with us. Because we are the world's only dedicated Sammy Hagar podcast. This is the Bogus Otis Show. I am Bo-host Brent. That is Bo-host Darren. D, my man, are you feeling it tonight?
Oh, yeah, man. This is an episode we've both been doing a lot of research, listening. I've been spinning the collection, too, since it arrived in almost all formats. I got a boatload of notes. Maybe a rant? What about yourself?
I'm ready. Listen, and before we get there, we always have to have our thirst a little bit quenched. And this is a big thanks and ode to Brian Hodes, the COO of Sammy's Beach Bar Rum and Sammy's Beach Bar Cocktail Company, who joined us on our last episode. Great conversation with him. It was an hour that made me probably more thirsty than I'd ever been. And so, you know, I've got to ask, what is filling your glass tonight, sir?
Well, Brian inspired. He was awesome. I'm glad we upped our game on that episode, too. We're like, man, look at this guy's resume. We're going to have to like, we always do our research and compare notes. But I feel like for this one, we're like, let's get this. We can't ask that question. Let's ask that question. Right. But yeah, he's great. He inspired me, man.
Yeah, listen, it ended up being, I think I said this to him at one point in the episode, it was like a masterclass in marketing and business management. It was incredible.
Yeah, he was great. So yeah. Tonight I'm having a Sammy's Caliente Margarita on page 218 of the New Testament, which I call Sammy Hagar's Cocktail Hits. But this one is it's two S's of Santo and a sprig of agave syrup. And some lime juice, and then you put a slice or two, actually calls her a couple. I just put one just to step into this, a slice of jalapeno. And it kind of gives it kind of a peppery kick, which is, imagine a margarita with a slice of jalapeno in it. It's pretty damn good, man.
Yeah.
So check this one out if you can.
I love it. Listen, there's nothing simple about it. It sounds very complex, but you know where I'm going with this because I said the word simple. There's a new single that just came out the other day. It is a cover of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Simple Man, and it's Sammy with former Lynyrd Skynyrd drummer Artemis Pyle. This is an album that's coming out in February. It is a all-star cast tribute to Skynyrd classic tunes, and they've already released the single for Simple Man with Sammy. It popped up in my Spotify feed and I was like, whoa, what is this? I got to check this out. What do you think?
I love it. How has Sammy not done this song before is question one. And question two is, why is this guy not in Skynyrd? Great drumming, huge drums. Why is he not? Yep. I'm not a huge Skynyrd expert, so I'm not sure why he's not in the band or.
Yeah, I think he's ebbed and flowed and been in and out a couple of times. And obviously they've had some significant lineup changes and of course the horrible tragic accident that happened back in 1977
that's why this is released, right? It's the 46th year of that
46
terrible tragedy
years. Yeah, that's right.
It's cool, man. I love when Sammy pops up on tribute albums.
Oh, totally. And listen, you said question one, why has he not sung this before? And I would echo that. I mean, to me, his voice, his tone, his inflection is perfect.
Yeah,
for a song like it's perfect.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, like if he had sung this, you know, peak era Sammy, late 80s, 90s, I think he might have been a little bit too. His voice is kind of mellowed, maybe a tone down, which I think it's a little bit of more of a rasp to it. I think matches it now than if he'd sung it like 25, 30 years ago, right?
Yeah, you're right. So, you know, again, you and I are simpatico because you just nailed the perfect segue here. After Simple Man, the biggest news to come out lately is we got a tour next summer.
Our thirst got quenched on many different levels.
I mean, we speculated last episode, you know, is this the return of Chickenfoot? Is it the Joe Satriani?
I guess we were half right.
Silhouette. And yeah, I mean, we were pretty close. No doubt about it.
Satriani. I saw the headstock, even though people are like, no, this dude's got hair. I'm like, well, he wears the bucket hat, but there's no disputing the Ibanez headstock. So I knew that it was Satch. I was thinking it was going to be a Chickenfoot reunion, but he kind of said it himself on Stern, or where did I see it? Satch said it somewhere. I mean, the internet caught fire, right? But basically, Satch was saying it didn't look like it was going to be able to work for a full on Chickenfoot reunion record and tour. So this is it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So they're blazing across the US and popping up to see us just down the road in Toronto at the end of July, right in the middle of this tour, actually.
Awesome. I love when Toronto's great because it's usually in the middle of the tour. So everyone's in peak form when they hit Toronto, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you think about it, if we wind the clock back, the last Van Halen tour in 2015 came to the Bud Stage, formerly Molson Amphitheater in Toronto, in August of 2015. So when this show rolls around and the stop in Toronto happens, it's only a handful of days away from being 9 years to the day that the last Van Halen show was in Toronto. So,
and you know what, dude? Like, I was like, well, you know what? Maybe this time I'm just going to buy lawn seats and, you know, they'll be back again, right? They seem to be, you know, they'll come back again, not knowing that was it, right? I usually get way better seats, but you were front row?
I was, yeah, front row, right in front of Eddie. Yeah. And I just, you know, basically stood there with my jaw on the floor for 2 hours.
Yeah, I was like, I'm just going to do lawn seats this time. They'll be back because I saw them in 12 and 7 and, you know, I was way up front for those ones. So I'm like, I don't know why I chose for this one. I'm like, they'll be back. They seem to be gelling. Yeah. Probably another album will come next and they'll come back again.
No, that's right. But here's the thing. We learned that lesson, right? Because we're up front from Fanatics this time for sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Like, I mean, look, it had to happen, right? I mean, look, it coincides with the Collection 2 coming out.
Yeah.
And look, man, I know there's people debating like, oh, you know, it's not if someone named Van Halen is not in the band. It's, you know what? I don't care about that anymore. I feel like, look, man, the fans have been, it's been strenuous being a Van Halen fan all these years. Someone had to do it. And I feel like Sammy gave, you know, Alex and whoever else in the VH camp time to do something. I mean, look, and this is probably going to get me in trouble, but Taylor Hawkins, awesome. Great drummer, right? Foo Fighters, you know, great guy, great drummer, great person. Within days, they had something organized. And you know, in the pantheon of rock legends, Taylor is not Eddie Van Halen. Nothing happened. Well, here we are 3+ years, right? So, I mean, this is it. Thank you, Sammy. Those guys tried. I feel like if I was Sammy, I'd be like, look, man, you had your chance. Clock's ticking. Let's get going. Collection 2 is out, validating just how heavy and hard Van Hagar can rock. So I say bring it. So I say if you don't like it, don't go. But I mean, it sounds like everyone's stoked about it. I think it's going to be the show of the year.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the ticket sales from what I've seen, just watching a handful of cities in the first few days that they went on sale, I'm playing mostly outdoor, you know, amphitheaters and sheds and that sort of thing. And you know, a lot of them have very similar seating configurations in terms of the bowl and then the lawn seats up at the top. And anything in the 1, 2, and 300 level, you know, are gone or mostly gone within a couple of days.
It was gone. It was funny because I got kicked out twice. I don't know what's going on. They got some bugs they need to figure out in the Live Nation thing. Is it Live Nation or Ticketmaster? I don't know. Whoever I got in there, I select my seats, and then I go to the next window to pay.
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm just sitting there. I went off to watch TV or something. I'm just basically looking down to my credit card.
Yeah.
Just to confirm that the numbers that I had punched in are still there on the screen. And I had lost the tickets. It said those two tickets are not available. So when you click on them, shouldn't that hold them?
Yeah. I mean,
for at least a minute.
There's that little countdown that says,
but I didn't even get that. It was gone. So I looked, so I pick them, go to the next window, just looked at my thing, click on buy. Those tickets are gone. Go back to queue. And I was like, what the?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Ticketmaster is now owned by, controlled by, like, Live Nation controls pretty much everything. So,
well, we got tickets. We're eighth row. We're happy.
Yeah, we're happy.
But it was a little bit of a, you know, a heart-stopping moment where I was like back to the queue and I'm like, oh my God, those tickets are gone now?
Dude, buying concert tickets is a stressful proposition, especially if you're looking to be down front. There's no question about that. So collection two, we wanted to devote some time to dig into this little release, which comes really closely on the heels of the release of a remastered version of the Live Right Here Right Now, which also came out on vinyl as well as CD.
Yep.
And Sammy, some time ago when that release happened, made a comment in a number of interviews, sort of like, you know, that this is the first one, or, you know, something alluding to, you know, more was coming. And lo and behold, we get a remastered package of all of the Hagar era VH albums. And I think tonight is going to be an interesting conversation between you and I. And as I
have not compared notes, we have not compared notes.
No, we haven't. And as I was driving home tonight, I was like, I feel there's going to be a little role reversal happening here. And I'm not going to let that cat out of the bag, but you've said a couple of things that have led me to believe something. And you clearly know where I stand on all of these albums. And I think that in some cases, I might have an opinion that becomes what yours was, and vice versa. I've got a feeling that's, I think that's a road that we're heading down here. So we wanted to kind of break down the collection and talk about some specific songs that, again, independently, we each chose as, you know, sort of favorites or standouts or something with a special meaning. So before we hit into that, I just wanted to ask your thoughts, because the internet, God bless the internet, has had a lot of opinion and things to say about Satriani playing the Van Halen stuff, the reaction to the video clips that are out there on the Stern show. And it got me thinking. I actually asked a couple of my guitar playing friends, and I didn't ask you
I thought I was cheating on me.
I didn't ask you because we're gonna have this completely unrehearsed conversation.
All right.
And here's what's interesting. I asked them, "What do you think of Satriani? You know, the bits that that you saw on Stern, and who do you think would be other guitar players that might be able to, if you were looking to replicate Eddie's tone, because we know Satriani's he's a different kind of player, a different style, uses different gear. He doesn't sound the same, which, by the way, I think is a good thing. But I said to them, who else could jump in and play that role? If you were looking for someone who could hit Eddie's tone only.
Tone, overall mastery of the licks.
Well, I mean, a little bit of that, but who would sound like, if you closed your eyes at these shows and you listened,
right?
What guitar players would come to mind as you would think that Eddie is on the stage still? And I got a top five from two guys who are guitar players. I'm curious to hear your reaction to this.
Okay.
In no particular order, but here's five names that they said, if you were looking to have someone to replicate Eddie on this tour, here's five guys that could nail it sounding exactly like Eddie. Okay.
And I'm not in that top five, obviously, because if you saw me trying to learn Pleasure Dome, I need to go back and keep woodshedding.
You're number six. You're number six on the list.
A tough song, man.
I know. I saw your video clip of that, and props rusty to you, man. That it's tough though. That's a hard
song. We can get into that song specific, but just the first 10 seconds of that song would defeat many people right there.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear it. Top five. Wow. Okay. Because I thought the list would be. I think the list would be smaller than five, but let's hear it.
Yeah, so here it is in no particular order. I'm just going to say all five of them, and then you give me a reaction. So five guitar players who could replicate Eddie's sound and tone, note for note, sound for sound, on this tour. And the five names that were given to me by these two guitar-slinging pals of mine are Dweezil Zappa, Pete Thorne, Phil X, Paul Gilbert, and good old Nuno from Extreme. Those are the five.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Wow. Okay. There's a couple, there's a, two names in there. I was a little bit like, oh, wow. Okay. Never thought of that, but yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So what's your initial reaction? What do you think?
Well, look, I'm always stumbling across Phil X playing all kinds of stuff. That guy's amazing. And he was a Triumph. He was in Triumph, right?
For one album, he was
Canadian connection. Yeah, I think he could do it. Yeah, I think he's got the tone, he's got the chops, he's got the passion, 100%.
Yeah,
I still would say Satch over him because I feel like we're getting twofer here. We're getting best of Van Halen and Chickenfoot.
Yeah,
with Jason.
Yeah, no doubt, absolutely.
Nuno for sure. Nuno's, you know, in a way, he's kind of, I guess, in guitar communities, at least that I participate in online. It's like a lot of people have almost bestowed to him next in line to kind of, you know, to be officially within that handful of people who could be allowed to play Eddie type licks in public. Yeah. So, yeah, I think for him, for sure.
Yeah, interesting. And they said Dweezil because, you know, he obviously spent a lot of time with Eddie. And I think he learned a lot from Eddie to, you know, kind of capture that same tone and sound.
He's amazing. He's, I'm sure everyone has seen it who's listening to this podcast, that he has that video up on YouTube of him executing Eruption pretty much note for note, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Paul Gilbert is an interesting one. Didn't Paul Gilbert play for a time as part of was he with the G3 tour with Satriani and Vi for a little while?
I think he was. I can't remember now. I think he was, though. But I like him, but I feel like his tone is too far away from Eddie. I mean, so I love Paul Gilbert. I love Mr. Big. I love his stuff. I feel like he's too far away, though.
Yeah, I can tell you, we're going to come back to this in a future episode as well, because at least one, and maybe both of these guitar-slinging pals of mine who are lifelong Van Halen fans, as we are, we're going to get them actually to come on the show, and we're going to do a whole episode just talking about riffs and tone and guitar styles and gear and... you know, these guys are like you, they dive deep into that stuff. And so I don't want to give, you know, anything else away, but, you know, I started asking them some questions about what are the differences between an Ibanez guitar and a Wolfgang guitar. And, you know, they started talking to me about the necks and the wood that, is used to make the body and the pickups. And, you know, they sort of said, there are a myriad of things, not the least of which your fingers, that go into, you know, your collective sound when you're playing a guitar and what your kind of signature sound ends up being. So it was an interesting, quick kind of back and forth with them that really got me going. You know, we've talked about it for a while about, you know, having Andy as one of them, you know, who helped us with a little bit of sound engineering on our show intro and outros. And so I think, you know, let's get those guys on and dive hard into some gear and some tone and some big riffs and all of that. But it was interesting to start a conversation with them that was kind of centered around.
Very cool.
Okay, who's going to capture that Van Halen sound, right?
Well, it's funny because I was watching the gear. No, I'm a tone chaser as well, and I was watching the gear that Satch had on Stern, and he had the EVH pedals and stuff going on, right? So,
yeah. Is he? I wonder if he'll pull a striped guitar out and play.
I was
thinking
about that, but you know what? I feel like that's maybe one step too far,
too much.
You know, plus he's got great guitars of his own. It's and I also the fine folks at Ibanez will probably say we draw the line right there. No, exactly.
Yeah, right. Seriously. Hey, and listen, those Chickenfoot painted guitars look pretty freaking cool too, right?
Yeah.
So let's pause this piece here and dive into the collection. And
but tell your friends to start learning Pleasure Dome right now, okay?
Yeah, we'll get a jump on that for sure. I wanted to just put a pin in this and segue back into diving into the collection with a quote that I found from Joe Satriani that was in the Life magazine Van Halen issue that came out in 2020, right around the time of Eddie's passing. The last page of the magazine was had quotes from a whole bunch of people just, you know, saying words about him. And there was actually a Joe Satriani one there. And he said, Eddie put the smile back in rock guitar at a time when it was all getting a bit broody. He also scared the hell out of a million guitarists because he was so damn good. Right. I mean, and that kind of says it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, people, I saw some stuff, people giving Satch a hard time on Stern. It's 7 a.m. Right.
Yeah.
And that kind of, I mean, I think that was from what Sammy was saying, like that was their rehearsal aside from Satch being the incredible player that he is and probably knows a lot of these songs, you know, somewhat already. It's 7 a.m.
Yeah, 7 a.m. And thank you for saying that. Also, it was like a rehearsal on live TV, right? Like it just, I don't know. I've gone back and watched those Stern clips a few times and, you know, I don't even care if he plays perfectly or sounds exactly like Eddie. In fact, I don't want that. I want his interpretation. And watching those clips, there was a couple times where I just sat back in my chair and went, whoa, this is going to be good.
Yeah. You know what? I'm with you there, man. Like, look, as much as, you know, Eddie is the reason we're talking about Van Halen as much as Sammy, right? I'm a huge, you know, Eddie's the man. You're right. I don't know if I want someone to be getting it perfectly or trying to be Eddie, which goes back to him, you know, if he ever would Satch play an EVH Frankenstrat. I don't want him to, right?
Yeah.
I just want to hear these songs served up. You know, it's been far too long, man. I want to hear these songs served up. I think Satch is the guy, and I want him to, you know, obviously be faithful where he's doing his, you know, he's getting as close as he can. But I also want to hear a little bit of him too, right? I like Satch. I'm a huge fan of Satch.
Yeah, yeah. Just turn it up and rip through a killer set list, right?
And as much as I love Steve Vai, I feel like Satch is still the guy I would go with. Was Steve Vai on your friend's list? No.
He was not. No.
Oh, interesting.
No. Interesting. So that's another topic for...
I feel like he's, you know, he's owned by Roth's people.
Yeah, there's a bit of that for sure, right? There's a little bit of...
I love Steve Vai, but I still like Satch. I like his tone and vibe, and plus it's chicken foot. I feel like I said before, I feel like it's we're getting 2 for 1 here.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So how about 4 for 1, actually 5 for 1, if you include the rarities disc, the collection 2 is out. We wanted to spend some time talking about this tonight, dive into a few specific songs, but before we get into the details, just overall, what is your impression of this release?
Okay, so I have a bit of a disclaimer. I'm not an audiophile by any means. I am not a mix or mastering engineer or recording engineer.
Okay? That makes two of us.
But like many of us listening, and yourself included, we have heard these albums, I don't know about you, probably the same, probably many of our listeners the same, every day, probably for the better part of 4 decades.
Yeah.
Okay. I also play guitar. So I've learned those, to hear these songs from a guitar and a musician playing standpoint. So I feel like, although I have an opinion, which is the internet is rife with opinions, I feel like, you know, we have opinions, and much like our listeners too do as well, that are, you know, on the foundation that we have listened to these, we know every note and nuance of these albums top to bottom. So I'm bringing that. That's how I came to this assessment, was like how I remembered these songs from all the different formats. Because I've had these, like yourself, on every format. I've worn them out of every format, right? So that's what I bring to the table. That's what I was coming to the table with. Like, how do I remember this song? Because it's not like a painting where you can't listen to two things at the same time and really kind of compare them. You kind of just have to bring your musical memories to the table, then kind of compare it, right? So I tried to listen to it in my car. I got a decent stereo in my car. I have an amazing Sony Bluetooth stereo. I had headphones. I was trying to listen to it, you know, on CD. I was trying to listen to it in a variety of formats before I kind of came to my final assessment.
Yeah. I like it.
Fucking good. It's fucking good.
Yeah. I mean,
you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, well, and again, I've also kind of shied away from reading too many other ones because I didn't want to be influenced
buy them. There's a few things I'm not quite sure about, but I think for the most part, they sound great. I feel like in an order of, I mean, look, to me, balance, I couldn't hear too much of a difference in balance, because balance, in my opinion, is perfect. It sounded great when it came out, right?
Here we go.
Oh, okay. All right. Here we go. But then I feel like, you know, backwards to 51, I feel like the farther the album was away from balance, the more I could hear a sonic improvement. What about yourself?
Yeah. Very interesting. There are some pieces of what you said that I absolutely 100% concur. And I'm going to go back to what I said a few minutes ago. I feel like there might be a tiny bit of a role reversal, because I've come around a little bit about an opinion on one particular album, and I'm sure you know which one I'm talking about. And I feel like, because of a couple of things that you've said when we've been chatting off air, I feel like you've kind of come around a little bit the opposite way to one that is near and dear to me, that you've always kind of been like, I don't know. So this is interesting to me. I think overall, the sound on this remastered collection is bigger. I think it's brighter. I think that in a very interesting way, I mean, everybody goes, oh, it's Eddie's guitar and Sammy's voice. I mean, naturally, that's what you're gonna go to first. But here's a broad observation for me about this whole thing. I went, holy shit, I hear more of Alex's drums than ever before.
Sometimes, and to the detriment of Eddie's guitar.
There are some tunes that we're going to talk about that you just nailed it. I was like, I actually hear the drums over the guitar. It's crazy. Yeah. So, you know, people are critical about, well, you know, the packaging sucks and they could have had more photos in there and they could have had some extras, whatever. And, you know, I get that, but I think at the end of the day, look, we got something, which is a massive leap forward, after years and years of getting nothing. Do I have a feeling that, you know, the fifth disc that, you know, when they kind of called the studio outtakes or rarities, they could have done something more with that. And a couple of things that really hit me as I was listening to it and kind of just looking at the overall playlist, you know, I was like, man, could you imagine if they, not even all, but if they captured some of the audio of the 1989 Tokyo Dome show, that is a great video out there, or a lot of people I've seen say, you know, the audio of Live Without a Net, you know, put that on a disc, or, you know, something like I Want Some Action, you know, that demo tune that got left off 5150, some cool pieces like that. I mean, would it be have been amazing to see and receive some of that stuff? Of course. But we have taken this music that is decades old and brought it right back up to being relevant today. And I, like you, I've listened to it with my earbuds, my headphones, in my car, and I'm like, this is big. It sounds big.
Yeah. You mentioned Tokyo and Live Without a Net. I feel like the enhanced bass, I feel like, yeah, I keep coming to kind of the same words. There's a clarity and a spaceness of individuality of the instrumentation. I feel like there's a little bit more, there's almost kind of a livey feel now. The instruments have their own space to do their thing. And I feel like the drums are big. And I feel like biggest benefactor of these kind of enhanced drums, and this, I don't know, maybe you're going to throw something at me, maybe we're going to lose listeners for this, but I feel like 5150, whatever knobs they were twiddling, kind of nudged those synth drums, or whatever you call those drums that Alex was playing, to sound more like a real acoustic snare at times.
Yep. I would agree.
Is that just me saying that?
Nope. I 100% I agree. So let's talk about, I have Good Enough as one of the songs on my 5150 list to talk to you about. And to me, the kick drum and the bottom end of that song is way more pronounced in the remaster. And Sammy's voice was always great in 5150. It's, It's like bright and out there and really, really high. But it's funny. It almost made him sound like a stronger, more youthful voice to me, even a bit like VOA albumish. If you look at half a dozen songs on VOA, it kind of gave me that feeling. And I think it was only because it's like taken up from here to here. But the drums, for sure. I mean, there's no question across the board. Whatever they did, it has brought out the drum sound on almost every single song on that.
Yeah, collection. I feel like Alex, you know, he's claimed now his name is in big bold letters. His last name, big bold letters now.
Yeah.
Beside Eddie, because I feel like across the board, it kind of leveled them all up holistically from a drum. Well, I mean, first of all, we have to break down Van Halen by its unique recipe sonically. So it's Eddie, Alex's crazy drums, Mike, and Mike bass, but Mike voice, and then the background vocals, obviously the singer Sammy, and then the keyboards too, right? I feel like each of those kind of got an upgrade, but its own space and bandwidth to hear a tone. Like, you can actually hear the bass for Mikey, and I'd like to know, did he have any input in this, or is it just done and released, or was he like part of the process? Because you can actually hear him fretting. I can actually hear him fretting at times. Those details are lost. There's an enhanced detail in the playing where I can actually hear his fingers fretting, but I felt like with the enhanced bass and the drums, I felt like the subsonicness of Al and Mikey were locking on a different level across a lot of these songs, to where they kind of represented themselves to me in a new light.
Yeah, I agree with you. You made a comment a minute ago that, you know, it's almost given you know, something closer to a live sound in a lot of this, and that for me definitely comes out. And I think it's because I feel the bass drum like in my pounding in my chest a bit, and the vocals are higher, louder, clearer, crisper. So it is almost like you're standing, you know, in the arena watching.
And I don't know the process. So do they, like, when they're twiddling the knobs and whatever, are they doing the whole song at one time? Is it holistically to an album? Is it holistically across all the albums? Or is it like holistically across all the albums, but also instrument by instrument in layers? And then the whole thing. I don't know how they do it, but I feel like each element of the band just sounds a little crisper and there's more detail. You know, and also we're talking about a time here. And Eddie's, you know, talking about Eddie's guitar tone. We're talking about a time here where almost album to album, his tone was changing more drastically. And look, I'm sure that, yes, there are differences between Van Halen 1, Van Halen 2. I already know all that. But I'm talking about big, big changes in his tone. He was changing almost every album here. Yeah. But I feel like there's a holistic that kind of levels them up and unifies them in a way here. Because I don't know what the process is, but, you know, he used a lot of chorus, and that wet sound really benefits from this mix, I feel.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. You're right. I mean, you know, the Roth diehards are, you know, probably not gonna like either of us for what we're saying, but, you know, if you take the first five Roth era Van Halen albums, the guitar sound is pretty similar on all of them. It wasn't until 1984 where you started to hear a little bit of a change.
Yeah.
Versus, to your point, from 5150 to OU to For Unlawful to Balance, there was absolutely an evolution there. And he, you knew it was him. You hear it on the radio, even if you didn't know the song, you hear it on the radio and go, that's Van Halen. You know that.
Yeah.
But he definitely was evolving. And I think that that's probably a product of a few things: maturity, even more tinkering with his gear and his setup and his guitar, because technology was getting better. So he had more at his disposal. But I feel like you hesitate sometimes to go, well, you know, it was more mature or grown up or whatever. I mean, that's not a bad thing. It just, to me, I think, in that time from, you know, the mid 80s to the mid to late 90s, it was like he grew up and evolved so much and just kept looking for
That's such a good point, man.
I want more. I want different, right?
I'm going to use that as a segue. Well, look. I feel like this package is why we started the show. It wasn't to defeat or diminish the Roth era. I love the Roth era. I love those albums. But I feel like the Sammy's era and tenure needed to get the respect to stand equal to that. And that'll probably rile some people up for sure. But I feel like, look, the music was going to change anyways. Regardless, forget it. Pretend that Sammy never joined. Pretend Joe Cocker or whoever, you know, all those other names that were floating around at the time. Let's say that they joined. The music was heading this way anyways. I think, in my opinion, Roth would have probably ousted himself or left on his own because the music was changing and not to really towards the areas, you know, that's where Eddie was writing, towards the areas that kind of meshed with Roth anymore. I mean, Roth tried to catch up with Skyscraper with this more melodic, poppy stuff, and it, you know, it just didn't happen for them. Yeah, I feel like it was heading that way. So, like, for all the naysayers against Sam, I say the Van Hagar era deserves the legacy to stand proud right beside it. This stretch of music kicks some serious ass.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question about that. And I think to your point about, you know, the evolution or the change, that was definitely...
Was
yeah, no, for sure it was. I mean, 1984, again, you play it, and you go, yes, it's obviously Van Halen. I know that. You can tell when you hear it on the radio. But the 1984 album, in my opinion, is drastically different from the five that came before it. You could see that it was a product of them maturing, using more technology, experimenting, learning, you know, ways that
evolve.
They could
just evolve their setup. Right?
Yeah, 100%.
I feel like 1984 was like the peak of that, where they were going. You know, I feel like,
and all of this that we're saying is let's be real here. No one is saying anything disparaging about any of the records that came before. It's just it was a very clear difference in direction and evolution and a change in the sound.
Yeah. And I think Sammy fit where they were heading. And I think sonically it was a great match. And I'm just so happy these have now been, you know, revisited and repackaged and repainted up because they sound fantastic. There are a couple things I don't like though.
I expect and I hope to hear that from you for sure. 5150. What do you want to hit? What stands out to you on?
Well, why don't you were about to talk about Good Enough. Hit up Good Enough.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think for me the interesting thing about Good Enough, and we learned this or were reminded this again with the Stern and Eddie Trunk interviews of the past week. Good Enough and Summer Nights, you know, a couple of the first songs that they worked on together. You know, Sammy has talked for years about this and said it again with Howard Stern, that Summer Nights, you know, the band kind of was already working on the music and they had it, you know, kind of somewhat together. And Summer Nights in particular, he just kind of started like scatting and, you know, singing over it. And then all of a sudden the lyrics started to fall into place. So, you know, for me, there's something magical to see a song like Good Enough and Summer Nights, hopefully both of which we're going to hear next summer on the tour, to see both of them be punched up, cleaned up, taken to another level is kind of exciting because you go, this is literally the origin of this era when Sammy joined. It was the first stuff that they worked on together. And so for me, I think it's, you know, it's really special. 5150 is a very, I would call it a very polished album in its sound overall versus like a Carnal Knowledge or a Balance. It's, which is, again, not to say that they're unpolished. It's just in a different way. And so 5150 for me has always loved it, yes. But it's kind of given a bit of new life to me. Songs like 5150 and Good Enough and Summer Nights and even Dreams. I've always loved Dreams. Those tunes all just feel like, you know, I'm back seeing the 5150 tour in 1986 because they sound so good, right?
Yeah. No, it's funny because, you know, I was kind of, I wanted to rush to go right to OU812 to see if it was going to be, you know, represented as a brand new album.
Yes.
But I feel like, yeah, and the bass is definitely larger there. I feel like it didn't fix some of the audio things that were kind of happening during that album. But I feel like the bass is much, much higher. But I feel like 5150 maybe benefited in that enhanced bass. You know, I really feel like that one really just, like I said, I don't know the process, but however they put it back together.
Yeah.
The subsonics of Mikey and Al's, you know, more clarity in the notes. Like, I feel like his snare and his kit was almost dismantled piece by piece and re-put back together.
Yeah.
But there's a subsonic to it that just gives those songs an extra power.
Oh man, you literally took the words out of my mouth when you said that snare drum. And for me, when we get to balance, there was a couple of moments listening to some of the remastered tunes on balance where I was like, I feel the bass drum right in my chest, and I can hear him hitting the snare drum every time. It's like, man, it's so pronounced and it sounds killer. So that's really interesting to hear you say that. But before we jump to OU812, and we're going to have some fun with this one for sure. This is the first part of my role reversal that I've teased a couple of times.
I was going to say, when are we going to start disagreeing?
Is there a single standout song on 5150 remastered for you that really just puts it over the top?
I feel like AFU goes to kind of a different level.
No, on 5150.
Oh, 5150? Okay, great.
Yeah.
I was going to say, well, 5150 was one of the ones that really stood out. I mean, like that song, it, to me, is it's epic. It just sounds more epicer.
Yeah.
If that's a word.
it is.
But I felt like Inside. I feel like Inside, the forgotten gem at the very end, the keys and the bass, again, with the bass and the drums, and then the keys put back in. And those are very low, you know, very low end keys. I feel like that song kind of comes to life in a different way. I was really surprised to go back to that one, right? It's just a fun kind of awesome way to end a really fun record.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, Inside has always been one of those songs that I think some people are just like, you know, skip. But I like it for the cool factor, because it feels off the cuff and fun and goofy, and you know, that was the essence of
Van Halen. Right? Yes.
No, dude. Yes.
Why is that a bad thing?
No, exactly. Shall we talk about OU812? I'm very excited about this.
Well, it's funny because I was jumping to that one because I did. There is a big sonic change. So again, when I listen to this in different formats, when I listen to it on Spotify, so digital streaming, through my Bluetooth tower, when it goes from this big thump from Inside to Mine All Mind, there is that little bit of a drop again. It's just OU812. Yes, it's enhanced, but it just doesn't, I feel like, reach the level that 5150 got hit, right?
So I know that you're a huge OU812 fan. Our listeners know that you're a huge OU812 fan, and they know that I'm not as big of a fan of OU812. Here's a bit of the role reversal. It's already happened. You opened the door. I'm now a card carrying member of OU812. You've converted me with this remaster totally.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So what jumped out at you?
A couple of things that I'll hit you on. When we talked to Sammy in Detroit, he actually singled out the song Cabo Wabo as one of the remasters that really stood out to him for really sounding, you know, even bigger and even more enhanced. And I mean, that song was always so powerful to begin with. It almost stood on its own, separate from the whole rest of the album in my view. But the interesting thing really is, you know how, you know, he's got, I don't know if it's a bit of like palm muting of the strings or a little bit, but that riff in there, like the little thing that's all the way through Cabo Wabo, to me, that was like, man, it actually goes parallel with the bass, because you can hear a bit more of Mike's bass in Cabo Wabo now. So that little like riff and then his bass line, I was like, whoa, this is cool.
Yeah, well, I feel like Eddie really embraced that wet sound, and the chorus was part of his arsenal in the late 80s, mid 80s. And I really feel like this, whatever they do to it, adds an extra shimmer to that kind of wet So it even feels more beachy. But we always talk about musical threads, how songs kind of connect. I feel like the enhanced bass and subsonic of the bass and the big drums, I feel like that song now levels up to be the real sibling to Amsterdam.
Ah, yes.
Kind of like the, you know, the slower tempo, big monster heaviness. I feel like it levels up beside Amsterdam now. That was the big takeaway I got from OU into.
Oh, I love that. That's cool. I think you're right. I mean, they're kind of in their own way. They're a bit anthem-ish, you know, as songs for their own reasons. And that's I hadn't thought about it, but that's really interesting that you've singled that out. The other one, you said Mine All Mine a couple of minutes ago as well. And that one, that was a song that actually was the opening tune on a lot of shows on the Balance tour.
Yes.
Kind of interesting. And for me, I loved Mine All Mine always, but it always bugged me because it felt very, there were elements of it that were kind of like tinny and a bit hollow almost because there was so much absent the bass.
Right.
But this is a song that I still always loved the song, but it was like a little thing that nitpicked and bugged me about it. Now I feel like with whatever they've done, tweaking their remaster knobs, it's kind of brought that sort of what I call kind of like a bit of a tinny hollow sound down. It's more tempered. And again, here we go. The theme from the start, Al's drums are right out there. Like I almost hear the drums before I hear some guitar stuff on Mine All
Mine. So yeah, I didn't make specific notes, but there's a couple times it's like, and again, I'm bringing my musical memory to it. I think it was Spanked, but I feel like sometimes the drums just kind of almost overpower Eddie's. A couple moments here and there, right? Just small moments. But, you know, again, there could be only my own personal memories of just, you know, listen to it on a hissy tape from 1989 where the high-end treble stands out, you know, higher back then, right? So it's hard to really, you know, you're going by your musical memory when you judge these things, right?
Yeah, no, it's so true. The other one that really stood out for me on OU is another song that I've always loved, even though it's on not my favorite album, is Feel So Good, for a whole bunch of reasons. I think the lyrics in Feel So Good are incredible. It was a great video. The whole concept of the video, them sliding back and forth, was, you know, super cool. The keyboard kind of synth, that kind of like bassline hum that it had, it also now to me meshes better with the guitar riff. I can, where it was all kind of mushed together before, in a song like Feel So Good, I hear that kind of like low foundational keyboard hum clear, and I hear the guitar riff right over top of it clear.
Yeah, there's a better separation. I feel the same thing is present in When It's Love, so you can actually hear the synths, but also you can still hear Mike. And look, I've got to get Mikey on to talk about this, specifically this, right? Kind of in a way, this collection, a lot of it's about him
You
know, being reintroduced.
Oh,
but I mean, look, now that you can actually, especially on OU2, you can now hear notes and fretting and their, you know, Source of Infection. You can hear the stuff he's doing clearer now. Look, any of the stuff that Eddie said about Mikey over the years, I think we can all say that should be put to bed, because look, you can hear what he's doing. It sounds awesome, right? Like
absolutely,
we always knew.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, so with you being such a huge OU812 fan and constantly noodling and trying to learn parts of other songs and riffs and all of that, is there a song on OU812 hearing the remastered version that is inspiring you to go, I want to go and learn to play this song or this part of the song or re-practice this riff from that album specifically?
That's a big setup. The answer is no. Sorry, should I change my answer? No, because I just, you know, in many ways, even though that album is not my entrance to Van Halen, it's my entrance to Van Halen when I got a guitar. So I think I pretty much almost exhausted that album. But I will say, and we've had discussions about this, so that maybe this is where we do the role reversal, because you've always been a, you know, huge flag waver for An Awful. And I look, and I bought the album. I loved it when it came out. I spun it. It just, for a long time, it wasn't one I went back to, especially the back half.
Yep.
I just didn't go back to it. I don't know why. I just didn't go back to it.
Yeah.
I feel like that album really reintroduced. And I wasn't really expecting that because it sounded so good. And just like Balance sounded so good. So I wasn't really expecting. But again, it was that subsonic. The drums just sound huge, huge.
Yeah.
I can hear and see the rim of the snare this time when I hear it. I can hear Mikey especially hitting the pocket with Alex, that it represented a whole bunch of songs on the back half to me, where I'm like, gotta learn those ones, right? So that's why I was meddling around with Pleasure Dome foolishly. But that one just sounds monstrous, right? The back half, especially the solo for In and Out, my God, Mikey and Alex just click almost to the point where you can't actually hear the solo, to be honest. That was one of the ones I was like, that one a little bit diminishes the how I remember the guitar standing so forward, right? But it sounds just so massive.
So here it is. This completes the role reversal that I was talking about earlier. I've gone big thumbs up more to OU812. And you know, from the Awful Carnal Knowledge, you're right. I waved the flag for that album. I'm a massive fan of that album. And I have been right from the very beginning. And I think it's because of that, you know, it was the start of the grunge era and, you know, heavier, darker, you know, we've kind of talked a little bit about, you know, is it sort of comparable to Fair Warning in its darkness, right, or heaviness, right? And for me, still love it always. It definitely fit with the era and the time. But this album in the remaster overall, for me, I was actually a little bit disappointed. I was hoping for more because there's big tunes on this, like Judgment Day and Dream Is Over and Top of the World, that, you know, I love and have always, you know, had great affinity for them. And I didn't hear a lot of big difference or change in the song.
And right now, two things I felt weird about that song. There's those synth bass punctuations, right? Like, boom, you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
They seem smaller and not as impactful as I remember. Mm. Again, that could just be my memory. But in the outro, when Sammy's singing, you know, turn this thing around.
Yep.
Those feel way farther back than how I remember them on the tape.
Mm.
Like, I felt like his voice, and I love that part, is he's kind of like hitting the melody.
Oh yeah, it's like, so awesome.
Farther away, right? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like that part, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Bring that back, put that back.
Like you're talking about those last handful of seconds too, where there's that little, like all of a sudden that little drum piece kicks in too, right?
Right, yeah. Just before that.
Yes, yeah.
He's saying a few things like, turn this thing around.
Yeah.
Right now. That part.
You know the thing with right now? The thing with right now too is that it's such a great song for so many reasons, but it's spoiled a little bit for me because it's been done so many different ways live. Like sometimes it's a cappella, sometimes it's unplugged, sometimes it's, you know, changing around the sequence of the lyrics, sometimes it's a shortened version. It just, that is a song that I wish that Sammy would have stopped messing with and just freaking sing it.
All right, right? So we may have to put this back in, insert this segment in, because this is probably going to lose listeners, but I really like the way he does it now. Right now? I like the way that he did it kind of on that lockdown sessions. Yes. I love that version, right? Is it better? Yeah. No, it's not as iconic, but I freaking love the arrangement.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't we do, here's the thing for a future episode or mini episode or part of an episode, we should talk about the whole lockdown session thing. And maybe it's a mini episode because it's a short versions of all the songs. It's one that we really have never talked about, but there's some interesting weird stuff on there. And now that you've raised it with right now, it's kind of
got myself coming back to it more than I thought I would.
I want to go listen to it now because I kind of forgot about it.
My biggest gripe with that album is just, so it's song, they're like half songs, right? So the album's over as you're getting into it, right?
Yeah. Every song is like 2 minutes.
But I actually find myself really liking Heroes a lot.
Yeah.
And I really do like that. Like just the first 15 seconds of that version of Right Now could go on forever on repeat,
yeah,
in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely for sure. But now that you've said it, it makes me want to go back and listen to it because I'd kind of forgotten about it.
Hi, this is Bob Bates. And if you really want to know about Sammy Hagar, you catch up with the Bogus Otis Show. If you don't, you might miss out.
These albums are so ingrained in us by history and nostalgia and years that we all bring a lot of, I guess, oral baggage to this. Like, that's how I heard it. You know, I had what it could have depended on the Walkman you first heard it on. It, that pitch and that treble setting is, you know, and also we're talking about a time here where like Walkmans had different settings for the equalizers. Like, depending on how you had those set, that's how that album is baked into your brain.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You're right. So you said Pleasure Dome. What was the point that made you go, okay, I need to pick up my guitar and play around with this one? Why Pleasure Dome?
Well, For Unlawful is a huge album because in many ways it's weird. Like 5150, his tone is a lot different than 1984. And then in a weird way, he's for OU812, Eddie kind of goes back to a 1984 kind of tone in some spots. But you see a glimmer of what's to come with the Soldano and the Music Mans. You see a glimmer of that. But then for Unlawful, it's a big change from the, you know, the typical Eddie sound as we knew him up to that point. But I feel like this new kind of shimmer really or this new whatever they did kind of brings in a new shimmer to the chorus and the effects that he was using at that time. And Pleasure Dome, the first 30 seconds, almost every trick that Eddie invented or made famous is present, along with, you know, this crispness. We keep going back to the word Christmas and clarity. It really brings to the forefront the articulation that Eddie had. Like, you're moving around so fast to get to these harmonics and they're all perfect. So that's what really brought me back to Pleasure, especially the beginning of Pleasure Dome. Really reinvented itself, or really presented itself to me, right?
Cool. I love that. So see, I've made you by default a bigger fan of For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, and you've made me by default a bigger fan of OU812 too. We both won.
So should we delete those previous episodes where each waving the flag for the opposite? Or so were you okay with the pound cake beginning? Where they're talking and whispering being snipped off?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff, I don't necessarily pay.
To me, though, might as well be a note. That's like taking away a note.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Al with, is it Big Fat Money, where, you know, they're going to come in with the click track or whatever, and he's like, we don't need no stinking click, right? Yeah. It's like that, totally.
Yeah, again, I've heard Pound Cake so many times that I'm waiting for that banter before the song actually starts.
Yeah,
That was gone, so I've still wrapped my head around that missing, right?
Yeah, no, that's fair. I can hear what you're saying there. It's almost like if you know that little back and forth banter that Sammy and Satch had with Down the Drain, if that was gone, you'd be like, what?
It's art, right? Like, if you're going to touch up the Mona Lisa, no one ever be like, hey, if we're going to put it in a brand new frame, let's just touch up the one eyebrow.
Yeah,
exactly. No, you don't touch it. Leave it alone.
You can't do that. That's right. So we come to Big Bad Balance. Balance, very similar to me as For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. No one who listens to this show or who knows me would say that, you know, Balance is an album that I have anything but incredible things to say. It's probably honestly one of my favorite Van Halen albums, top to bottom, front to back. This one actually, I've heard other people saying, you know, you didn't even need to touch it. Balance was perfect. It was, you know, so I mean, we had Mike Fraser on, who, you know, had a big role in the mixing of that album, and you know, don't touch it. It's perfect. It's already, you know, da da da. Fair, but this is another one again that for me balanced, and maybe it's because I have such an affinity for it. It just like punched me in the gut and the face at the same time all over again. And even to a better degree, I was like, how is it possible that the bass can get even lower? How is it possible that the drums on Balance can get even more punch in the face. How is it that Sammy's lyrics and singing, when he soars with some of his range in a song like Feeling, for example, like, and I was like, yep. It got better in all of those aspects. It just crushed it, killed it.
That's such a good point. It's been a decade, man, since, you know, 95 to 85. It's been a whole decade. So in that amount of time, technology turned over, you know, tapes are long gone, vinyl's long gone, we're into compact discs. So much has changed in just that short 10 years, right? I feel like balance was captured so current to the time, and I don't think things have really radically changed since that time. Like, clear is now clear, and digital tools were there then. So I feel like balance was kind of the first digital era album. So I feel like they took the balance recipe and added it backwards to all the other albums. That's why I feel like there's a leveling up to the balance recipe, because now it's all digital, right? So I feel like that's what's happened. So I feel like, you know, no, OU812 maybe not quite as leveled up in terms, especially compared to balance, but I feel like that kind of recipe that you just identified in balance, I feel like got a little bit of that magic dust on everything else.
Yeah, I think you hit a really good point there in terms of that sort of, you know, leveling up and kind of bringing everything to a level. There's no question, the balance record, the way that it was recorded, the way the sound was captured, it was so powerful, and they were so smart about the recording process. You know, working through the engineering process, the mixing process, I feel like there was a lot of thought and time and effort that went into getting that thing, you know, sounding as good as it possibly could, right? And it just, I mean, you think about the opening of Don't Tell Me, like, in that chugging, like, even you hear that again, and I'm just like, I said a couple minutes ago, some of the drums are punching me in the face, and it's the same with this, right? Yeah. It's just so powerful. And I'm going to come back to something you said at the very beginning. There's so much of these remasters across all four of these albums that they've brought up a level in terms of their power and their volume. And they all sound more live.
Yeah. 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 Which is ironic, because, you know, the Roth era was always so livey sounding, you know, there's such a live band captured on tape, you know, playing, you know, recording an album in a week or not. It does infuse kind of a live vibe back to these songs, right?
Yeah.
They sound more like you're there in the room listening to these, which I think is amazing. And songs like Balooch Ethereum, which I'm still wrap my head around, it doesn't go from Alex Solo into Balooch Ethereum. that's one thing I didn't like. Don't leave that alone. Don't touch Mona Lisa's eyebrow.
Yeah, big time, right?
It sounds, you know, again, the layering of the instrumentation was already stellar, but I feel like just that extra shimmer and shine really gives some space to each instrument that really is clear on stuff like Balooch Ethereum, Aftershock, all of it, right? Crossing Over, I felt it really had. I know it's on the rarities, but that was technically part of the balance. You
know? So let's hit that, because you've mentioned a couple of, you know, Crossing Over, Humans Being, there's, you know, the Balooch Ethereum on the, you know, Studio Outtakes Rarities fifth disc. You said earlier off air that you had some thoughts about that. And I think a lot of fans have had some thoughts about, you know, what the makeup of that fifth disc, what's on there and why.
I feel like I've given this a lot of thought, and I don't want to sound like a whiner fan. I feel like maybe they should have just left the albums untouched, and I'm fine to wait for another album or another disc later on that has a whole bunch of other stuff that some of these other songs could have been collected and put on, like Respect the Wind. But I felt like if they had, like you said, you know, as much as I want some action, I would love to hear that cleaned up and put on here as a rarity. I feel like if there's too much of that stuff, it might be overshadowing what's really shining a light on this era as it was, not for the extra stuff. Sometimes when you put too much extra stuff, it kind of overshadows the message. I feel like the message here is like the Van Hagar era stands on its own and should be respected, equally respected. Anyways, that said, I feel like of all the extra ones, I feel like Crossing Over really did benefit from those because there's so much going on sonically. And I felt like that kind of distance and space for the instruments to each kind of breathe on their own spectrum of sonic really makes that song come alive on another level. What about yourself?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you said what you did because you're right. You know, there's a part of me that almost wants to take back the comment that I made about, you know, why couldn't there be like, you know, put I Want Some Action on there or something or some of the live
summer nights
about.
Scatting, yeah. Right? You know,
I mean, when I hear you make the point that you do, you're absolutely right. I mean, Eddie often said, I mean, everyone has talked since his passing about, oh, you know, they're going to open up the vaults and they're going to go through the tapes and they're going to look for this and they're going to look for that. And will they release any of it? And, you know, well, there might be some dream amongst the fan base that, oh man, we want to hear that stuff. Let's also not forget that Eddie himself said, and I'm sure Wolfgang has repeated it, you know, in the last 3 years since Eddie's passing, there's a reason why that music wasn't released. The stuff that they released was what they felt was the best that they had and that they put out there. So if it wasn't released, it was probably because they weren't happy with it or they didn't think it was at the level they wanted. It's
save some for next time, right? Like you're right. Because I mean, like if they had brought out the collection one, which was all the Roth era, and there was a seventh disc that was all like extra stuff, I feel like that might have overshadowed the statement that just the albums pretty much on their own were, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like this is a good statement, like Van Hagar deserves the equal consideration.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think the two exceptions for me on that outtakes studio rarities fifth disc would probably be Humans Being, just because it's such a great song. And, you know, it came together, it was written, it was recorded. They did the music video all at a time where, you know, we now know there was such conflict in the band. And the fact that that song got finished and released is kind of a miracle in a way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that one's cool to have on there because it's such an important part of their legacy and, you know, what was happening at the end. The other one is Crossing Over. And you've talked about that. And I agree fully with you. I mean, to me, finally, now we have an official release of Crossing Over versus it being just a B-side. And because it was formerly a B-side, you didn't have it on any of the streaming platforms. Right. You couldn't find it. Yeah. And I mean, arguably that song is some of the best music that they ever did. It's one of the best songs they ever recorded. There's no doubt about it. So
imagine if they had just kept going, right? Like, yeah, it was just such a, I didn't notice a huge sonic change in that song. The one I did most, you nailed it earlier by saying, for Feels So Good. Now that the bass and the synths and the drums kind of have their separate space to do the thing, I feel like that really cleaned up. I know a lot of fans don't like the song, but I feel like Up for Breakfast kind of got another coat of paint just by allowing Eddie's guitar to kind of breathe, not get so drowned out by the synths and stuff. Right. I could really hear the more nuances of his playing.
Yeah. I think you're definitely on to something there for sure. There's no question that, there's a certain aspect of all of these recordings that have taken all of the instruments and all of the players and given them their own kind of, you know, center stage billing. But at the same time, they at an even greater level mesh so well together.
Yeah. Right? And
yeah. It's
I really feel like they looked at the whole, like the set, and were like, how can we holistically bring these together?
Yeah,
you know, make them even them all, level them all up to be kind of equal. Like I think I'll go back to what I said about what you were saying about how great balance sounds. I feel like they kind of leveled up the other albums to be as close as they could to balance. So balance, you might not feel there's a giant leap in sonics because it was already so close, right? It's already so almost perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. So the collection to the 2024 Best of All Worlds tour, it's coming next summer. Not that I love to wish time away, but I'm pretty excited for next summer. It's going to be a lot of fun. last word to you on the collection two.
I will use our tagline. What is understood need be discussed.
I love that right there. And with that, we're the Bohos out.
The Bohos Bonus Show is produced by Right Now Entertainment. Hosted by Darren Bristow and Brent Kinnair. With audio and production assistance by Andrew Wright and Record Ready in association with Right Now Entertainment. What is understood need be discussed.
Bogus Soda Show. Too fucking funny.